Prokofiev's Sonata Opus 94 for flute and piano, played by Emmanuel Powell and Eric Lesage at their Proms Chamber Music Recital at Cadogan Hall in London last Monday. It was introduced by Catherine Bott. Well, she'll be back this Monday for a Proms Chamber Recital by the cellist Yo-Yo Ma and pianist Catherine Stott, performing works by Rachmaninoff and Graham Fitkin. That's Monday lunchtime at 1 o'clock. But now we return to Cadogan Hall for our live Proms Saturday matinee, which is presented by Christopher Cook.
A very warm welcome to this afternoon Proms Saturday matinee and to a programme that celebrates one of the most remarkable women of her era, Hildegard of Bingen. The BBC Singers, conducted by Robert Hollingworth, together with Stevie Wishart and the Ensemble Symphony, we'll be exploring how that era, the High Middle Ages, reaches forward into the music of our own time in works by Benjamin Britten and Harrison Birtwistle, and a brand new Proms commission from Stevie Wishart herself that takes us back again to the great Benedictine abbess of the 12th century. Everything that we know about Hildegard is quite simply remarkable, and all the more remarkable because she was a woman with stoutly independent views in the very masculine Middle Ages. An administrator, a writer, a visionary, a preacher, and a wise woman whose advice was sought by kings and princes. I'm sure that if she were alive today, Hildegard would be handbagging the whole world and trying to make us try harder. She was also a composer at a time when the church had its own doubts about music. Didn't the devil perhaps have all the best tunes? Not for Hildegard. The prophets not only wrote psalms and songs, she declared, but they also used different musical instruments in tuneful accompaniments to their songs. So there. Music, she wrote, is the swaying bridge between heaven and earth. I sang and wrote melodies for the glory of God, without instruction from anyone, even though I had never been taught how to read music or to sing. It's precisely because she follows her own instincts that Hildegard of Bingen's swaying bridge is perhaps so original in its construction. In what is the first ever performance at the Proms, the Ensemble Symphony are going to perform three pieces from Hildegard's Symphonia Harmoniae Coelestium Revelationum, which would appear to be a liturgical cycle related to a number of different church feasts. We're going to hear a pair of antiphons, the second of which celebrates St. Rupert, 7th century missionary to the Germans and founder of the city of Salzburg. Then a responsory would ask Mary, Mother of God, to intercede with her son on our behalf. Stevie Wishart directs the seven members of Symphony in a selection of pieces by Hildegard of Bingen. Will you please welcome Symphony to the platform? Pray for us, unto him that was born of thee, Mary, Star of the Sea. A heartfelt plea for intercession. The group symphony sang three pieces from Hildegard of Bingen. In the first of them, processing through the audience here at Cadogan Hall to the platform, they were directed by Stevie Wishart, who herself played the hurdy-gurdy, and the soloists were Maura Smiley, Penelope Turner, Vivian Ellis, and Victoria Cooper. In the winter of 1974 and 5, knowing perhaps that he hadn't long to live, Benjamin Britten began to look back to the Middle Ages for lyrics to set for the Wilby Singers, a consort of soloists recruited by his partner, Peter Pears. But if the sacred Middle Ages are remembered in the 8 texts that Britten selected, so is the gloriously profane Middle Ages. The great illustrated manuscripts of the medieval period may, of course, be full of the holiness of God, but there in the margins, the monkish scribes drew and painted all manner of naughty, profane things. And so it is with Benjamin Britten's Sacred and Profane. This is not a song cycle in the conventional manner, with each movement bound together by a clearly spun set of musical threads, although there are connections between the individual songs. What matters is the juxtaposition between holy thoughts and the everyday. So St. Godric's hymn, which begins the sequence, begs for grace, and then I'm on wax wood, laments God's man's madness, that distracted state of mind that sets us apart from the rest of creation. Meanwhile, spring is busting out all over, In Lenten is come, to be followed by the long night and a very chilly winter. A proper time, then, to meditate on Christ's suffering on the cross. But then in the 6th song, the old Adam is out again in Carol, with its tale of a maiden having a good time on a moor. That's a mossy bank moor, not a moor from Spain. We're back with Christ on the cross in Ye That Passen By, and the cycle ends, as does life itself, with a death. Benjamin Britten's Sacred and Profane is performed now by the BBC Singers, and to conduct them, please welcome Robert Hollingworth.
Sign the Maria. Oh!
What a grisly catalogue of ailments that flesh is heir to. Misty eyes, dribbling mouth, heart trembling, and hands shaking. Brave indeed the man or woman who can sing out that final line, "For the whole world, I don't care one jot." The BBC singers, the soloists, Olivia Robinson and Margaret Cameron, conducted by Robert Hollingworth, sang Benjamin Britten's Sacred and Profane with its last positively Chaucerian meditation. It was Harrison Birtwistle's fine opera Garwin that reminded us that there were medieval poets writing in English before the author of the Canterbury Tales. Garwin, with a libretto by the poet David Harsent, fashioned from the anonymous poem written in the late 14th century, was first performed at Covent Garden by the Royal Opera in 1991 and then revised over the next 3 years. But this was not Sir Harrison's first musical encounter with the story of the Green Knight, who tests the courtly honour of the Arthurian hero Garwin. In 1963, the John Aldiss Singers gave the first performance of an a cappella piece entitled Narration, a description of the passing of a year. This sets Brian Stone's modern translation of the medieval poem, in which the seasons move from Yuletide through crabbed Lenten time to spring and summer that seethes at hill and dale. Then harvest comes, and can winter be far behind when wrathful winds in raging skies wrestle with the sun? Here, of course, is one of Harrison Birtwistle's great themes, the turning of time, and if nothing else, a description of the passing of a year should remind us how deep a musician's memory can be, with Garwin the opera slowly growing in the composer's imagination for nearly 30 years. Its first performance at the Wigmore Hall was warmly welcomed, with one critic writing, "It's an enchanted piece. The language is direct and beautiful, but Birtwistle has not set the words in any conventionally picturesque way. Rather, it is almost as if he set the thoughts and images that they evoke." So now, the BBC singers perform Narration, a description of the passing of a year, and they're conducted by Robert Hollingworth.
Thank you.
The cycle of the seasons. So yesterday's winter returns, as is the way of the world, I swear. The BBC singers, conducted by Robert Hollingworth, sang Harrison Birtwistle's narration, a description of the passing of a year. We pass now back to where we began, to Hildegard of Bingen and a Proms Saturday matinee premiere here at Cadogan Hall, commissioned by the BBC Proms for this afternoon's concert. It's Stevie Wishart's Out of This World, a setting of 8 short texts by the great Benedictine abbess. And I'm joined here on this platform by Stevie Wishart. Stevie, no music actually survives from Hildegard herself for the text you've chosen, does it?
That's right. Probably towards the end of her life, she composed 3 or 4 songs without their music, but we still have the beautiful lyrics. And it's always been a dream of mine to be able to set the music myself for those songs, because since we've been gradually recording her complete works, I kind of feel she's somehow in my blood, and I want to develop that now for us audiences today.
And how did you set about selecting the text for this particular piece?
Well, there are only 4 texts, so I decided to set 3 of them, because in the very last song we had the idea that perhaps it would be a coda. In your introduction you said that we'll kind of come full circle in the concert. So for the last song, O Eterne Deus, I actually thread a kind of cantus firmus by the symphony singers that threads above the texture of the new composition. So we've got 3 songs of the lyrics that survive without the music.
And have you arranged them in a new order, or are they the order that we find them in the original manuscript that we use to locate Hildegard of Bingen's work?
No, I've used my own order, because actually I think of them as 4 separate songs that can be performed and perhaps sound best as a cycle, but also stand alone by themselves.
And you've said that it's always been an ambition to find the music for these songs that don't have music. How did you set about? I mean, do you simply try to create Hildegard's style, or do you try and create Wishart's style of Bingen? How do you do it?
Well, the nice thing as a composer, if you have influences from many different sources, and I do, because I love new technology, sensors and computers, and I also adore old instruments like the hurdy-gurdy and medieval chant, and of course the music of Hildegard of Bingen. The nice thing with a composer is you can bring all these threads together. And I started the piece trying to compose a very long melody, because she's a wonderful composer for these very long through composed melodies. Sometimes they last up to 8 or 9 minutes. But for the first few weeks, it just sounded like pastiche. So then I completely left that idea, went on to a later part of the piece, and then came back. And now I have created a long chant that doesn't sound like Hildegard, but perhaps has that intensity and the long direction of melodies that don't quite resolve. And I also picked up on, in our first two songs, you may have noticed that she used what we call the Phrygian mode, which is rather mysterious mode, which starts with a semitone. Da, 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 da. And I inverted that and used that as a kind of melodic cell for the music. So you kind of hear that threading through the middle two and a bit in the last piece, and you'll hear it in the fugue.
You began the concert by walking in with your hurdy-gurdy, with one of your soloists walking down the aisle too, which makes me think that space and the spatial arrangement of this music is very important. Is that actually always true of Hildegard's music, do you think?
No, but I think it's kind of often true of my music, because I work a lot in the studio with loudspeakers and surround sound and think about the stereo spectrum as well. And to me, really, a choir or an orchestra has all that potential. You know, we've got space within the performance area, if you like. And so I really wanted in this piece to bring out that spatialization, because in some ways you can then layer ideas in a very different way. I tend to think very horizontally in my music. So therefore, spacing it within the space helps us listen to those different layers of the horizontal musical palette.
Well, we're going to listen to just that in a moment. Stevie Wishart, thank you very much indeed.
Very much.
Well, Symphony are about to perform Out of This World. They're making their Proms debut today, but they've been part of the early music scene in Britain and in Europe and the United States for the past two decades. The ensemble was founded by Stevie Wishart in the late 1980s with the intention of combining improvisatory skills derived from traditional music with performance practice based upon thorough historical foundations. And over the years, Symphony have made a speciality, as we've heard, of the works of Hildegard of Bingen. But there's a modern as well as a medieval element to their repertoire, overlapping, as we're going to hear in the new piece, Out of This World. It's in four movements that essentially run continuously. Hildegard's texts are set in the original Latin, but also with English translations. The first we're going to hear is O Word of the Father, then O God Eternal. The third is O Creation of God, and finally, O Most Beloved Son. Well, everything is now in place. Stevie Wishart and members of Symphony are in the galleries behind and above the platform where I'm standing at Cadogan Hall, and the BBC singers are centre stage. And here to conduct them in the first performance of Out of This World is Robert Hollingworth.
Thank you.
Last Breath of Eternity. Out of This World by Stevie Wishart, the first performance of a BBC Proms commission. And it was almost out of the hall, with members of symphony arrayed across the balcony and the gallery here at Cadogan Hall, and the BBC singers and Robert Hollingworth below. Was that how Hildegard of Bingen heard her own music in her own religious house? That's an end to the sacred and the profane for this afternoon. But in next week's Saturday matinee, we're still keeping faith with faith. The cellist Natalie Klein joins the BBC singers and the Britain Symphonia, conducted by David Hill, for three pieces by Michael Tippett, including his setting of Gerard Manley Hopkins' poem The Windhover. There's the British premiere of Sir John Taverner's Populae Meus, and to the end, The Canticle of the Sun by Sophie Gubadalina. I do hope that you'll join me in a week's time. But now, here's Jill Anderson with the rest of this afternoon's BBC Radio 3.
Thank you very much. That was Christopher Cook at Cadogan Hall. And that concert will be available for you to listen to on the BBC iPlayer for the next 7 days. Well, we'll be live at the Royal Albert Hall tonight at 7:30 for a concert given by the Turnhalle Orchestra of Zurich, conducted by David Zinman. They start their concert with a UK premiere, a piece by Anders Hillborg called Cold Heat. And then they're joined by the pianist Maria João Pires for a performance of Mozart's last piano concerto, the piano concerto number 27 in B-flat K-595. Then, after the interval, a performance of Beethoven's third symphony, the Eroica Symphony. And you can hear all that live here on Radio 3, starting at 7:30 this evening. Well, next this afternoon, two jazz programmes, Jazz Record Requests at 5:30 and Jazz Library at 4:30, in which Alan Barnes joins Alan Shipton to talk about Archie Shaw's recordings. Before that, here's the pianist Joanna McGregor live in Buenos Aires in 2007. She's playing music by Astor Piazzolla. First of all, Milonga del Ángel, and then Liber Tango.
Thank you.
to arrangements of Astor Piazzolla's music by Joanna McGregor. They were Milonga del Angel and Libertango. Joanna McGregor was the pianist, the bass was played by Marcus van Horn, and Jacqueline Shave was the violinist. This is BBC Radio 3, it's 4:30. Now it's time for Jazz Library with Alan Shipton.
Today, Jazz Library focuses on one of the most flamboyant band leaders in jazz and one of the greatest clarinetists in its history, Artie Shaw. Joining me to talk about Artie Shaw's music is Alan Barnes. And Alan, let's just talk first about the fact that Artie seems to be one of the very few musicians who not only had fantastic control of the clarinet, but found new things that the instrument could do.
Yes, I think the most important part of Artie's actual clarinet playing, when you can always hear the beautiful sound and his overall ability on the instrument, but his actual upper register, I think, was unprecedented in those days. He was going right up to top C's and top D's in some cases, but with a fluency that's virtually almost impossible, I would say.
Did he develop special fingering, or did he modify the instrument in any way?
I don't think he modified the instrument from what I've read, but all clarinets are different, so you're always fiddling about trying to find another fingering, and often you use different fingerings for different notes, depending on the note that precedes or follows that note. But he could do all kinds of things in terms of bending the notes with his lips and this tremendous sense of the pitch being very centred and very emotional, the way he used vibrato at the top there.
We'll come on to perhaps some of the sources of that emotion a little later, but we might start with the very piece of music that he would have started his concerts with in the late 1930s, and that was his theme tune, Nightmare. Now, most people in the 30s had jolly, up-tempo theme tunes. We think of yes. Duke Ellington and Take the A-Train. Sure. But this is melancholy, minor key, and with overtones of his European Jewish background, the kind of klezmer overtones.
Absolutely. I mean, all his playing had the klezmer influence. But Artie Shaw, having a theme tune called Nightmare, is really part of the paradox of the man, in that he was seeking commercial success but running from it at the same time. And this is, I would think, one of his shots at his fans, who he sort of loved and despised at the same time. To have a theme tune called Nightmare is quite a statement, I think.
Nightmare, the theme tune of the Artie Shaw Orchestra from the very best of Artie Shaw on RCA, and that was Artie's own selection of the 16 or so tracks that he thought were the best of his recorded work. The band recorded in September 1938. Let's go back to the beginning of Artie's recording career, Alan, because he'd been a band leader by then for 2 years, and he'd already made the kind of radical changes to his lineup that were going to be a feature of his fairly short career as a band leader. He'd started out actually subbing for somebody else in the interval of a concert with a string group, and this seemed to be a very unusual context for jazz at the time. But actually, the recording we're about to hear is a very good example of just how he could make strings work.
That piece apparently was called Interlude in B-flat. And he was at, the CBS radio orchestra at that time, and he got some guys from the orchestra to run the piece through. And it got an encore at the concert. It was supposed to be a fill-in piece, and he had to play it twice. So this gave him the idea of keeping the same kind of lineup, four strings for four rhythm and himself. And the piece we're going to hear, Streamline, is one of the most astonishing pieces of virtuoso clarinet playing I think I've ever heard. It would be terrifying to have to play that, I think, and he takes it greatly in his stride. There's been a lot of adverse criticism of this particular band, saying the strings are stodgy and his clarinet playing wasn't what it became. But as far as I'm concerned, all the elements of Artie Shaw's style are there already, and the string writing sounds great. The rhythm section is fantastic. It's a charming track.
Streamline, Artie Shaw, with his string section of Jerry Gray, Ben Plotkin, Sam Persoff and Bill Schumann, in 1936 with the rhythm section of Joe Lippmann piano, Gene Stultz guitar, Ben Ginsberg bass and George Wetling on the drums. That's from the proper box, The Artie Shaw Story, which is a four CD set that takes Artie's career right from that beginning in 1936 through to his final recordings in 1954. We'll be coming back to that a bit later on, but we're going to return now to Artie's own selection, The Very Best of Artie Shaw on RCA, for a track that shows two aspects of him, really, Alan, which is both his formula for playing a song where the band takes an introductory chorus and then he states the melody with such extraordinary clarity that you feel he owns it. But also this is a good example of his composition. He'd written the piece Any Old Time and the very brief stay in his band of the singer Billie Holiday.
Yes, so there's lots of interest in this track. I'm impressed with the actual melodic content of the song. It phrases quite unusually for the time, I think, and his lyrics are okay for that kind of thing. When he states the tune after the band's done the tune, it's interesting because there's three registers on the clarinet. There's the Shalimar register, what they call the break area, which is the weakest area, and then the top well, there's four registers in a way, and there's the ultra high as well as the high register. And in this, Artie's around the break, and sometimes in the shallow, sometimes in the middle register. And the sound is exactly as strong in all those areas, which is another thing he could do, and project. I mean, to project in the lower end of the clarinet over a big band requires real projection on the part of the player.
Yeah, we could think of other players from the period, particularly players like Jimmy Noon or even Edmund Hall, where there's a quite discernible break between the lower register stuff and the rest.
Yeah, some clarinet players, of course, rejoice in the difference of the three registers. You know, I think Sidney Bechet was one of those. But again, perhaps with this classical command of the instrument, one of the things you learn is, if you study classical clarinet, is to try and even it all up rather than to differentiate between the different areas.
Just the asking, darling, any old time you need me, I'll be there. With love that's lasting, darling, all through the years we'll stand together, sharing the tears and stormy weather, and the sunshine will be yours and to chase away the blues, and any old thing you do, I'll see you through. So just remember that I am waiting, dear. If ever you want me, I'll be near. Any old time and any place where you may be.
Billie Holiday with Artie Shaw in 1938 with Any Old Time from the album The Very Best of Artie Shaw on RCA. It's also to be found on the Artie Shaw story on Proper, and we'll come back to that set in a minute. In 1938, Artie had swapped his string section for a conventional big band lineup, and I have to say that band is considered, I think, to be one of the best.
Yeah.
We're going to go back to the session that produced the opening track, Nightmare, in September 1938, to show just how this band could take a standard Cole Porter song and jazzify it. And this is What Is a Thing Called Love. I think it's a good example of Artie not playing the theme and actually going straight into a jazz solo.
Straight into the jazz thing, yeah. Well, I think you have to say he was a great jazz player. He suffered from something that Goodman did, which I think people thought he was so good he must have worked it all out. But I don't think there's any evidence he did. I mean, they were that proficient, I think. And that swinging. I mean, I think the thing that he's doing more now on these tracks, listening to them in context, is he's swinging even more than he did at the beginning of his career.
Yes, I mean, I think that grows as time goes on. And, of course, we forget that the swing era itself was evolving all the way through the 30s, so he would have been taking in influences from elsewhere. And one thing we'll discover about Artie as the programme goes on is that he never stopped listening to things that were going on both inside and outside jazz.
Right. Yes, he was always interested in classical music. Various stages of his career, I think he considered becoming a classical clarinet player.
That's interesting, isn't it? You were saying earlier on that there are hints in his early compositions of the classical training that he must have gone through. And it appears that at various stages in his life, he just set his mind on becoming the best at what he was doing. So when he was a studio player, he made himself the best lead alto.
Yes.
And then when he went into running a band, he not only wanted the best band, but to be the best clarinetist.
Absolutely. I mean, even if he was the most natural player in the world to play clarinet like this means you have to have a brain that's just clarinet, I think. The level of involvement with the instrument is beyond most people who would consider themselves sane.
What is the thing called love by Artie Shaw from the Artie Shaw Story on Proper, recorded in September 1938 by the Artie Shaw Orchestra. The same band in 1938 produced the huge hit record of Begin the Begin. We're not going to play that, but it was very much at the back of everything that Artie Shaw achieved in this period from 1938 to 9. And yet, his reputation with the young public in particular wasn't for playing the ballad style of Begin the Begin, but for hot, exciting jazz. And in 1939, when Buddy Rich joined on drums, there are a couple of recordings, and we're going to play one of them now called Traffic Jam, that really show the excitement in the band itself and communicate what must have been the feeling at those great theatres and ballrooms where they played across America. I mean, I can't think of a better example, really, Alan, of the band sounding live.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Buddy Rich injected so much energy into the band, and you can hear this band come alive in a way you can't even recognise it from the previous track. The phrasing's really together. It's a really tight band. And Artie himself does two amazing glisses in this, to the point they're almost impossible. You can't tell any join at all. His control of the instrument by now is complete. It's beyond me how he would be able to do that, and he comes out with hot jazz clarinet of the highest order on this track.
Now, you were talking earlier on about the way that he projected over the band. This is quite interesting. I suspect it was recorded, as many things were in the 30s, with just one mic at some distance from the band. You do get a sense sometimes that he's fighting the rest of the group, but you can still hear the clarinet sort of coming through the sections.
Well, he did have this incredible projection, and it's not about volume. That's the strange thing about projection. And it's not about cutting through in a way. It's like a great opera singer having this enormous, round, big sound that just fills theatres.
Jam, the Artie Shaw Orchestra in June 1939 with Buddy Rich on drums, Georgie Auld on tenor, and a full personnel which you can find on the Jazz Library website. That's bbc.co.uk/radio3/jazzlibrary. Well, it wasn't too long after that, Alan, that Artie Shaw did the first of his famous running away acts. And I think we've been trying to puzzle out between us exactly why he did this.
Yes, it seems that he sought success all his life, and whenever it came, obviously with the financial advantages of the situation, he'd just have enough. And he literally fled to Mexico for a long vacation, leaving Georgie Auld to try and fill the dates without him. I can imagine the disappointment of paying to hear the Artie Shaw band with the key figure missing.
It didn't last very long, did it?
No, it didn't. It petered out very quickly. And I think he had a record contract still to fulfil, or he might never have come back, maybe even then, but he did come back.
So he reappears from Mexico in Hollywood and, curiously, hired William Grant Still, the African-American composer, to do arrangements for the band.
Yes.
It looks to me like he'd never quite fallen out of love with the idea of strings and the classical orchestra somehow being integrated with jazz.
Yes, it's funny. In a way, it's almost a return to the first band before his great swinging bands, but not with as much flair, I don't think. The string writing isn't as good. And Grant Still, who'd written for Paul Whiteman and was an oboe player, so some of the string writing is a bit pedestrian.
The piece we're going to hear was controversial in its own right. It's Frenesi, which was actually a piece that Artie'd heard in Mexico and came to the conclusion was a Mexican folk melody. So he jotted it down and gave it to Grant Still. And only when the record had come out and was beginning to sell very well did he discover it was in copyright.
Right, well, that sort of negated the whole purpose of it, I guess.
I think it cost him a lot of money. Anyway, this was to be the second great Artie Shaw hit after Begin the Begin. It's Frenesi. Thank you. Hennessy, the Artie Shaw West Coast Orchestra in March 1940, with, again, a remarkable reconstruction of a band with a completely different set of players and soloists from the earlier bands that he'd led on the East Coast. This was clearly a commercially successful move for him, Alan, in the 1940s. And the other thing that sold in the millions, apparently, at the time, was the small group that he formed out of the band. I've never really been convinced about this, but I have to say the track we're going to hear, Special Delivery Stomp, is the first appearance on Jazz Library in 5 years of the programme of a harpsichord.
Yes, played by Johnny Guarnieri. And I have to say, played in this style, swing-style harpsichord, to my ear sounds like a dreadful sort of cheap early synthesizer. The fact that the notes on a harpsichord are plucked rather than struck, but they're struck by hammers on a piano, of course, and I think it just gives that little bit of delay that stops the thing perhaps swinging, as much as we know Johnny could swing on the piano.
Special Delivery Stomp, the Artie Shaw Gramercy 5 in September 1940 from the Artie Shaw Story on Proper. The band, Artie Shaw on clarinet, Billy Butterfield trumpet, Johnny Guarnieri harpsichord, Al Hendrickson guitar, Judd Denault on bass and Nick Fatoul on drums. You're listening to Jazz Library on BBC Radio 3 with me, Alan Shipton, and my guest, Alan Barnes, discussing the music of Artie Shaw. And full details of all the music, as ever, is on the website, and I'll give the address again before the end of the programme. The next piece we're going to hear is another of these huge successes for Artie Shaw, but I think in the whole pantheon of his work, his recording of Stardust stands out because the clarinet solo here, which, as you were saying earlier, people thought he'd worked these things out, but it's claimed that he didn't, he just made this up on the spur of the moment. It's got that kind of inexorable quality that a great Louis Armstrong or Charlie Parker solo's got. He's sort of revealing a hidden shape that's there, and it seems so right.
Absolutely. It's a spontaneous composition of the highest order, really. And it's so beautiful the way he plays it. He goes up quite high at one point and bending his notes around and lovely jazz expression in it. I think it was Buddy DeFranco who described it as the perfect clarinet solo.
It is, and particularly when it's set in the context of a really strong trumpet solo from Billy Butterfield to start with, and Jack Jenny's trombone that takes on from it. So got three really excellent solos, but his is just extraordinary.
Yes, it's sort of bookended by these two beautiful brass statements, but his really is the jewel in the crown of the arrangement.
Artie Shaw's famous recording of Stardust from October 1940 from the Artie Shaw story on Proper. We're going to move on to a piece that Artie composed for himself to play in an autobiographical film, which was, again, I suppose, part of his rehabilitation as a bandleader. Now this West Coast band was secure. By the end of 1940, he was back as a bandleader, and that period of aberration where he walked off from the earlier band was largely forgotten. Concerto for Clarinet is an interesting piece because it's sort of three pieces in one, really.
Yes.
You've played this, Alan, because I heard you performing it at the Barbican with Guy Barker's band last year. It's not exactly easy.
No, it's not easy at all. And I gave a kind of approximation of it, which went as well as it could have done, I think, in the circumstances. But, I mean, the original, it's a great showcase for Artie, though perhaps Concerto is rather a grand title for what we get, which is a couple of klezmer interludes, which are, I find, incredibly moving, actually. They're beautifully stated. There's a boogie section, there's a blues section. And it really, it's a cut and paste job of various ideas put together and absolutely perfect for a Hollywood film.